Austin 3:16 says, I just whipped your ass.
In the history of kings, there's never been one so majestic and revered as I, King Booker,
the King of the Ring.
Hear ye, hear ye. Greetings to all. Welcome to this very special edition of the Sala Monster Sounds Off podcast. This is episode 278, a special King of the Ring themed edition. I am the Sala Monster, and indeed it was 20 years ago, on June 13th, 1993, that WWE held its first ever King of the Ring pay-per-view event, which of course was won by future Hall of Famer Bret the Hitman Hart. Really, it was the Bret Hart story. That night at the King of the Ring, wrestling three matches in one night to capture the crown. In fact, there were several King of the Ring tournaments prior to 1993, none of which aired on television, pay-per-view, or anything like that. And I thought it would be kind of cool here on this 20th anniversary of not just the first King of the Ring pay-per-view, but my favorite King of the Ring pay-per-view out of all the ones that they did, to look back on the history of not just the pay-per-view shows, but the tournament itself, how far back it dates, the winners, some of the best matches, some other interesting notes from these shows, and pose the question, should the King of the Ring be brought back in some way, shape, or form, either as a pay-per-view, as a television gimmick, as it was a few years ago? Should the King of the Ring make a comeback? So we're going to get into all that, but let's start first with some of the early King of the Ring years. Again, as I said, the King of the Ring originally was conceived as a concept that was meant to sell tickets at a live event. In 1985, the first King of the Ring tournament took place, won by the Magnificent One himself, Don Morocco. And four straight King of the Ring tournaments from 1987 to 1991. There was no King of the Ring in 1990. But four straight tournaments took place in Providence, Rhode Island, at the Civic Center, which is something I had not realized until I had to look it up. So I thought that was kind of interesting, that Providence, of all places, would be the home for so many years to the King of the Ring tournament. But in fact, it was a way to get people to come to the event. It was a special attraction to lure people in to sell more tickets for the events. As I mentioned, Don Morocco took the first tournament back in 85. Harley Race won the King of the Ring tournament the following year in 86, and really became the first person, I think, to kind of transform that King of the Ring victory and parlay that into something that became a gimmick for himself on television. Because again, largely it was just done as a live event gimmick to sell tickets, but the first time it was actually acknowledged on television was with Harley Race in 86. He was doing interviews about it both before and after he won the tournament and went on to become King Harley Race. Now before that, Race had been an NWA World Heavyweight Champion several times over. He had been a big name on the national stage, but not quite on as big of a stage as what WWE would provide. But I guess they wanted to do something special with him. They weren't going to put the championship on him, so I guess this King gimmick was a way to give him something special to do. As ridiculous as he may have looked walking around in that robe and in that cape, and how it went against that tough guy kind of aura, I guess, that Harley Race had traditionally on television, it was still something special for him to do. So that's why he became King Harley Race and was doing well enough with the gimmick until he got hurt and was on the shelf with an injury for a while. In 1987, Randy Savage, who would later go on to become the Macho King, although that was a completely different storyline, Savage won the King of the Ring tournament in 87, which is something a lot of Macho Man fans may or may not realize. So he was the Macho King long before many of us ever knew. 1988, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, took the crown, perhaps as something of a consolation for not getting the WWE Championship, which at one point had been the plan for him to win the WrestleMania 4 tournament before Honky Tonk Man threw a hissy fit, wouldn't lose the IC strap to Randy Savage, and Savage ended up getting the championship instead, I think almost as a consolation to him. 1989, Tito Santana won the King of the Ring tournament. And in 1991, Bret the Hitman Hart won his first of what would be two King of the Ring crowns. So in fact, still to this day, Bret Hart is the only man to win two King of the Ring tournaments. So let's go through these pay-per-views here, because again, it was in 1993, the first event took place at the Nutter Center in Dayton, Ohio. It was Jim Ross, Randy Macho Man Savage, and Bobby the Brain Heenan on commentary. And in fact, it was only Jim Ross's second WWF pay-per-view show, and would prove to be his final one for quite some time. My thinking on that is, perhaps there was a little bit of jealousy on the part of one Vince McMahon, as from an announcing perspective anyway. Ross was so far ahead of everybody else. As good as McMahon was, perhaps, who knows, maybe that's where a lot of the bullying and stuff comes from over the years. But Ross made his debut in the company only a few months earlier at WrestleMania wearing a toga. Still did a pretty good job. They let him do King of the Ring, and after that, he disappeared. He was doing radio WWF, he was doing other things for the company. But he did not call another show as a play-by-play guy on pay-per-view for quite some time. Bret Hart, as we all know, won the King of the Ring tournament in 1993. And because of the way that Bret had lost the championship to Yokozuna at WrestleMania, Mr. Fuji throwing salt in his eyes, big controversy there at the end of that event, President Jack Tunney allowed Bret into the tournament without having to wrestle a qualifying match. Everybody had to wrestle a qualifying match in order to gain entry into the King of the Ring tournament, and Bret was the only man who was absolved from having to do that. Now, there is a backstory here, a political backstory, as far as why Bret would win the King of the Ring, not go on to get a rematch for the championship. Hulk Hogan had swooped in at the end of WrestleMania 9, beat Yokozuna in about 30 seconds, and became the WWF champion for what would be the final time until he made his return many years later. In fact, Hulk Hogan's final WWF appearance on television for 9 years would take place at this show. It wouldn't be until No Way Out in 2002 as part of the NWO when Hogan would resurface. Originally, the plan had been for a Bret Hart Hulk Hogan pay-per-view main event at SummerSlam back in 93, where Hogan would put Bret over for the championship and kind of pass the torch to him in the main event. There were supposedly posters made in the promotional materials for SummerSlam in that direction, pointing to Bret versus Hogan, which obviously never happened. Hogan had his issues. He thought Bret was too small. He felt a lot more comfortable losing the championship to a big man. And obviously, Yokozuna being well over 500 pounds fit that bill. Hogan did drop the championship to Yokozuna. Again, under controversial circumstances on this show, there was an exploding camera that played a role in the finish of that match. There was a disguised photographer who, for the longest time, I've been under the impression was played by Jim Cornette, although I don't know that that's ever been verified, jumped up on the apron because, again, Yokozuna was this Japanese hero. So you had all this foreign press, Japanese media, photographers all around the ringside area. And at the finish of the match, as Hogan was preparing to slam Yokozuna, this photographer jumped up on the apron, his camera exploded, and Hogan was blinded. Yokozuna finished him off, appropriately enough, with Hogan's own finishing move, the leg drop, pinned him and won back the championship. And it was after that match he gave Hogan the bonsai drop. You heard Bobby Heenan there at the beginning of the show shouting, Hulkamania is dead, and in fact, it was, for 9 years at least. But yeah, unfortunately, the Bret vs. Hogan match never took place. That would have been a big deal for that match to happen. It would have been a big deal for Bret Hart's career, and I can understand why he would be upset years later when, you know, he would find out exactly what had happened there, even though Hogan, of course, denied the whole thing and denied the fact that he never wanted to put Bret over. I mean, perhaps now he admits it, but for a while there, especially when Bret first came into WCW, Hogan, of course, denied the whole thing. This pay-per-view was also Lex Luger's final pay-per-view appearance as a heel. He played the narcissist character. He had a match with Tatanka that went to a time limit draw, 15 minutes. And it was only about 3 weeks later that there was Lex Luger dressed up in the red, white, and blue on board the USS Intrepid, body-slamming Yokozuna. With Hogan out of the company, it was Vince McMahon's idea to try to make Lex Luger into the next big American hero to essentially take the spot that Hulk Hogan had taken up for so many years. That flunked. That did not work out as well as they had hoped. So this was Luger's final appearance as a heel. The babyface turn came very suddenly. There was certainly nothing on this show to set that up. This show also started the feud between Bret Hart and Jerry Lawler that would last for more than 2 years. Now, Bret Hart really went through this tournament an injured man in a way, because he had the opening round match against Razor Ramon. And I believe it was during this match that Ramon had stomped on his hand, supposedly broke some fingers on Brett's hand. When Brett came out for his match with Mr. Perfect in the semifinals, his fingers were all taped up. He came out for the main event against Bam Bam Bigelow. Bam Bam Bigelow had beaten Hacksaw Jim Duggan in the opening round and had gotten a bye because of the draw between Tatanka and Luger. Bigelow would just be able to rest on his laurels. He didn't have to wrestle in the semifinals. He could kick back his feet and watch Bret Hart get his ass kicked, basically. And Bret took a butt kicking on this show. He wrestled three matches, obviously successfully. But if I had to pick matches from this show that really still stand out to me, my favorite matches, the best matches from each of these shows, certainly in 1993, the two that stand out to me are both Bret Hart matches. The match with Mr. Perfect in the semifinals, to me, was even better than their SummerSlam match at Madison Square Garden. And that match is a classic, and the finish of that match is probably a lot more, you know, of a classic than the finish to this match. But as a match, you watch this match here in the semifinals, both guys went almost 20 minutes. It was a great match. The first match at SummerSlam years earlier with Perfect and Bret Hart was hampered because of Perfect's bad back. I mean, Perfect was a wreck going into that match. His back was just completely messed up. God knows what drugs and pills he was probably hopped up on just to get through that match. So Perfect, as great as that match was, think about this. Perfect wasn't even at his full physical potential at that point. Well, he was in a lot better physical shape for this match, and it showed. This was just an awesome match. And even the Bret Hart Bam Bam Bigelow match in the finals, I don't think this is a match that gets the kind of credit it deserves. There was a false finish about midway through the match, which actually was probably the lamest part of the whole thing. Luna Vachon was billed as Bam Bam's main squeeze, his manager at the time. And it's very sad to think of all the names, not only in this match with Bam Bam and Luna, but really from this pay-per-view who are no longer with us. Bam Bam, Luna, certainly Randy Savage, who was on commentary, Mr. Perfect, all these people are gone. But Luna had given Bret Hart a chair shot that was the weakest-looking chair shot you'll ever see. And it led to, ultimately, it led to Bret being pinned by Bam Bam. But referees came out, restarted the match. Kind of a lame way to do that. I mean, Bam Bam pinned him right in the middle of the ring, but they restarted the match. And again, they went on to have a very, very good match together that I think is very underrated in a lot of respects. Bret Hart's performance on this pay-per-view is perhaps my favorite part of the whole thing, and it's why the King of the Ring 1993 is my favorite pay-per-view out of the whole bunch. In the early years, the King of the Ring tournament took place on that night. So yes, you had qualifying matches on TV, but the first round, semifinals, and finals all took place on this one show in one night, which meant that in theory, you had to wrestle three matches and be successful three times to become king. And to me, that's what made it work so well. You really had to get put through the ringer in order to become King of the Ring. And Bret certainly was run through the ringer on this show. Bret Hart was great in that he had this uncanny ability to make it look like he was really getting his ass kicked, even though he wasn't getting his ass kicked. He certainly looked like it. The way he moved around, the bumps he took and everything, you just really felt like, damn, man, this guy's getting wrecked in there. And I think, again, that's why this tournament worked so well. That's why the story they told here works so well, and why it's my favorite tournament of the bunch. But during the coronation ceremony, Jerry Lawler came out to confront Bret Hart, say that he's the real king. One thing led to another. Lawler attacked Bret, and as I said before, they went on to feud for many, many years, and ultimately their feud culminated in a Kiss My Foot match at the King of the Ring 2 years later that we'd rather forget. Shawn Michaels and Crush had a pretty good little match for the Intercontinental Championship on this show as well, which I think is worth mentioning. From there, we move on to the King of the Ring pay-per-view in 1994, which to this day, I believe, may have been the only WWE pay-per-view ever that Vince McMahon missed. He was recovering from neck surgery just before the steroid trial, which critics at the time suggested perhaps that McMahon had timed the operation so that when he walked into court wearing a neck brace, he may gain some sympathy. Perhaps it worked, because obviously he got off on those charges. Big story here in 1994 was the making of Owen Hart. Owen Hart, who had beaten his brother Bret in a classic match at WrestleMania only a few months earlier, was being groomed for yet another championship match against his brother. And Jim the Anvil Neidhart was going to play a role in this story. The Anvil, of course, was Bret Hart's former tag team partner, had been out of WWF for many years. Bret had a champion versus champion battle on the show with Diesel for the WWF Championship. And obviously Diesel has Shawn Michaels in his corner. So Brett said, I have a surprise to counteract Shawn Michaels. And that surprise turned out to be his former tag team partner. And Bret Hart and Diesel had what I would consider to be a pretty good match on this show. Probably their second best. This match is actually on the new Dungeon Collection DVD that WWE put out recently. And again, of the three match series that these guys had from 94 to 95, I put this at second best. I just found their Royal Rumble match the following year to be incredibly boring. So I would slot this at number two. The story they told here was Jim Neidhart cost Bret Hart the match. Diesel may well have had the match won. He gave Bret Hart the jackknife powerbomb. And before he had a chance to go make the cover, the anvil ran in, inexplicably, and clotheslined Diesel for the disqualification, giving Diesel the win. Anvil went to the back, and it was, you know, kind of bizarre, and probably a lot of people, you know, younger fans as I was at that time, really didn't put two and two together. But that would play a role later on, because Owen Hart would go through the tournament, he would face Razor Ramon in the finals, Jim Neidhart would come back out during that match and attack Ramon, turning heel, and helping Owen Hart win the crown. The story was that they wanted to keep the championship on Bret so that Owen, when he got the title match, could say that he beat his brother Bret to become the champion. And this is where, during the coronation ceremony, Owen Hart, you know, talked about, I am now to be referred to as the King of Hearts. It was a great way to put Owen over as something special. And it was really in 1994, this show, where the tournament became a stepping stone to a title match at SummerSlam. But, you know, even then, that only lasted about 2 years. The other years were, that was the case, were 2000, when Kurt Angle won, and 2002, when Brock Lesnar won. But if we're really going to be honest with each other here, no disrespect to Owen Hart, the 1994 King of the Ring, really, is remembered for one man. And that man's name is Art Donovan. Art Donovan played for several teams in the NFL. He was also a player for the Baltimore Colts. And being that the King of the Ring pay-per-view was taking place in Baltimore, Maryland, he was WWF's invited guest as a color commentator. He was going to be joining Gorilla Monsoon and the Macho Man Randy Savage on commentary, not just for one match or one segment, but for the entire show. Now, Art apparently was actually a very good player, played for a couple of different teams, three different teams, I should say, in the NFL, and was inducted into the Hall of Fame back in the late 60s. Art Donovan may well have been a Hall of Fame football player. He was not a Hall of Fame announcer. And what I'd like to do right now here is just throw it to a little clip montage of Art Donovan commentary. Listening to it will do a much better job of explaining it more than I ever could in my own words. So without any further ado, I give to you the glory that is Art Donovan.
Hello, everyone, and welcome on Gorilla Monsoon, along with the Macho Man Randy Savage and Baltimore's own football legend, NFL Hall of Famer, Art O'Donnell.
Now, let me just stop this right here. Let me just put a stop on this for a second here, because you may have heard Gorilla Monsoon say Art O'Donnell. That probably should have been an omen of things to come, that he would actually get the guy's name wrong right at the beginning of the pay-per-view. It is, in fact, Art Donovan. And I guess somebody just forgot to fill Gorilla Monsoon in on that, so just wanted to point that out. Let's continue.
What's the girl over there screaming at?
Well, Art, she wants her man, Bam Bam Bigelow, to be victorious here and move on to the semifinals.
Oh, I see. Okay, now I get it. Randy, is this one of the wrestlers?
He's one of the best.
He looks like a businessman. How much does that guy weigh?
500 pounds plus, Art.
Well, that's not fair. The only guy, the only fellow only weighs half the amount. How much does he weigh, Tatanka?
I'll tell you, if I had to guess, Art Donovan, I would say somewhere between 260 to 280 pounds.
Really?
That's Shawn Michaels.
Is he another wrestler? That's like sticking your fingers in a face mask. Can you stick your fingers in the guy's eyes? That's not kosher.
I'm not sure that actually happened, Art Donovan.
The referee's stealing the belt. Where's the referee going with the belt?
That's okay. He's just taking it out and saying, man, don't worry about that.
How much does this guy weigh?
600 pounds plus.
Who's the fellow with the American flag?
Oh, Donovan, that's Lex Luger.
Oh, okay. Gorilla, is he dead?
Yikes. Savage tried to be nice. Monsoon gave up on the guy early. That much was obvious, especially when he got his name wrong. But by the midway point in the show, Monsoon and Savage both pretty much started ignoring him, like he didn't even exist. Yeah, he would ask questions, and The two of them just wouldn't even acknowledge his presence. At one point, I'll never forget it, they put the camera on the announcers at ringside, and you see Art in the shot, and then slowly they crop him out of the shot, so all you see are Monsoon and Savage. Why nobody thought to send someone out to give him the hook after the first match, I'll never know. But you know what? I think I once referred to R. Donovan on the Sound Off as the worst announcer of all time. But when I listen to those clips again, I take that back. He's still better than Miz on Main Event. At least Art was entertaining in a cringeworthy type of way, but entertaining all the same. Miz is a robot who parrots what he thinks they want him to say and is boring. Art Donovan may have been a lot of things on this night, but boring was certainly not one of them. Art Donovan is actually still alive today. He'll celebrate his 90th birthday next year. And Savage and Monsoon are no longer with us. It just feels wrong to me. 1995 will go down as one of the worst WWE pay-per-view shows of all time. Perhaps with the worst King of the Ring winner crown. This was the year that King Mabel was crowned. There were some funny moments during the coronation ceremony. Mo, his tag team partner who would become Sir Mo, with Mabel now being king, read a royal proclamation from this giant scroll. He took forever to read this proclamation. The fans were not happy at all with Mabel winning the King of the Ring. I believe this show took place in Philadelphia, so you can only imagine. There was so much garbage and debris being thrown at Mabel. At one point, something hit him in the face. I don't remember if it was a cup. He looked like he was not thrilled with that at all, as I don't think most people would be. Just a poor decision. It was Vince McMahon's call to, book Mabel as this monster heel to go against Diesel at SummerSlam, and you can only imagine how that match turned out at SummerSlam. It was actually one of the reasons why Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon ended up having another ladder match that year. Originally, it was going to be Shawn Michaels and Sid for the Intercontinental Championship on that show. And when Vince McMahon looked at the lineup for SummerSlam that year and he saw matches like Brett versus Isaac Yankem and Diesel versus Mabel, he knew he had to save the show somehow. And that's why they put Shawn and Razor back together 17 months after the first ladder match, and they certainly delivered on that show. But yeah, 1995 King of the Ring is one of the, I can't even say one of the more forgettable ones. It probably is the most forgettable show. They had a whole bunch of other matches. There was a main event of Diesel teaming up with Bam Bam Bigelow against Tatanka and Sid, representing the Million Dollar Corporation. If I remember correctly, Diesel was injured at the time. I think he had an elbow injury, staph infection maybe, or something like that. But I can't really point to one single match on this entire show that was really any good. They had the Brett Jerry Lawler Kiss My Foot match, which really was nothing special, with a finish that was kind of disgusting, to be honest with you. They even had a backstage skit after the match was over of Jerry Lawler basically vomiting all over the place in the bathroom. He was brushing his teeth and vomiting while he was brushing his teeth. Just, really stuff that you'd rather put out of your mind. The 95 King of the Ring is highly forgettable. 1996 was better. Of course, 1996 King of the Ring is well known for launching a little something called Austin 316, which was born that year. Steve Austin was in the King of the Ring tournament facing Mark Mero in the semifinals. In fact, if I remember correctly, I believe it was during this tournament that Austin had what would have been a quarterfinals match on TV against Savio Vega. That may have been where he debuted the Stone Cold Stunner as his new finisher. By this point, this was the first year that they were doing only part of the tournament on pay-per-view, and in my opinion, this was the start of the demise of the King of the Ring tournament as a pay-per-view concept when they stopped doing the entire tournament in one night. Austin and Mark Mero had an awesome semifinal match. Mero went for a move at one point and kicked Austin accidentally in the face, and Austin legit needed about 16 stitches in his lip, so he went, had the stitches put. I don't know if he went to a hospital and came back, or if they did it backstage. Had 16 stitches put in his lip and came back out to wrestle again later. That's a tough son of a gun right there. Shawn Michaels and the British Bulldog was in the main event for the WWF Championship. They also had a pretty good match. Really good, in fact. It went well over 20 minutes. It was a rematch from their pay-per-view main event the month prior. That was the Beware of Dog show, the infamous show where a storm knocked out power, and the only matches people who ordered the pay-per-view saw were the first match and the last match. Everything else in between, the feed went out, in the building, the lights were out. They had to do the pay-per-view over again, essentially, 2 days later. But they had a really good match on this show. Mr. Perfect was the guest referee for the Sean Bulldog match, and it's probably worth going out of your way to see if you've never seen that match before. But back to Austin. Austin had that great match with Mero, came back out, faced Jake the Snake Roberts in the finals. The story they told here really had nothing to do with Austin. It was all about Jake. Jake had made his return to the company earlier in the year. He was a changed man. He was a born-again Christian. He had a new snake called Revelations. Wasn't in the best of shape physically, but seemed to be doing better than he had been previously in his life. Obviously, that would turn out not to be the case. Jake would go on to go through a lot of bad stuff in his life, but the story they were telling here was a story of redemption. You know, could this guy, could the old guy, could the veteran actually win this thing? And he made it all the way to the finals. Vader, who he had beaten earlier, had attacked him and injured his ribs. So the question was Jake even going to be allowed to compete in the finals? He told Gorilla Monsoon he'd be okay. He wanted to do it. He came out, and he lost to Steve Austin. Steve Austin cut that great promo on him. That's where the whole 316 part came from. It was from Jake's newfound religiousness, and it just came out. It was nothing that was scripted. It was nothing that was pre-planned, certainly by the company. And the phrase Austin 316 was born, and it was actually the very next night on Raw that you started seeing Austin 316 signs. It wasn't long after that the t-shirt came out, and it really started a revolution in wrestling. It started a revolution in that company, certainly, and it launched Austin into the stratosphere. Now, it's not as though if Austin didn't win the tournament that night, if he didn't cut that promo, that he would have been a mid-card guy for the rest of his career. I believe Austin would have been in the same spot anyway. Maybe it would have taken a little bit longer for him to catch fire and for the company to recognize that this guy is marketable, which Austin 316 proved. But what is a great what-if question is in terms of Triple H. Triple H was originally supposed to win the 1996 King of the Ring tournament. And the MSG curtain call incident kind of derailed that. That was the incident where Diesel and Razor Ramon had already signed contracts to go over to WCW. It was their last night in the company. At a house show at Madison Square Garden, Razor lost, I believe, to Triple H, and Diesel lost in the main event to Shawn Michaels. Now, Diesel was a heel. Razor was a babyface. Shawn Michaels, who Diesel had just wrestled, was a babyface, and yet, at the end of the show, all of them, Triple H came out, who had been a heel up to that point. They broke kayfabe. They broke character. They embraced. They hugged. They celebrated in the ring. These days, it really wouldn't be that big of a deal, but back then, it was a huge deal. Shawn Michaels was the champion, so you weren't going to punish him. Diesel and Razor were already gone. They were going to WCW. You couldn't do anything to them. So the heat all fell on Triple H. And the plans for him to win the King of the Ring instead were changed to have Austin win the tournament. Triple H went on to really be jobbed out quite a bit. And in fact, if I remember correctly, I think he lost to Jake the Snake. I think that might have been a qualifying match. That's how Jake got into the tournament. Although I could be wrong about that. So yeah, Triple H really got screwed over. Had Triple H won the King of the Ring in 96 and Austin did not, it begs the question how things might have been different. Again, I think in the end, both guys would have ended up in the same position that they ended up being in anyway. But perhaps it would have delayed things a little bit more. Maybe the Attitude Era would have taken on a little bit of a different look had Triple H won that tournament and they kind of cast Austin off as somebody who didn't belong in the main event scene. What's interesting about this is even though Austin won the tournament, this broke the streak of guys winning King of the Ring and going on to a title match, because at SummerSlam, instead of wrestling Shawn Michaels in what would have been a kick-ass match for the championship, Austin was relegated to wrestling on the pre-show. It's kind of like The Miz wrestling in the main event of WrestleMania and retaining his championship, and the very next year he's wrestling on the pre-show, you know, or 2 years later, whatever. Austin was wrestling Yokozuna in a completely meaningless 2-minute pre-show match on the free-for-all. So it's not as though he won this tournament and immediately went on to bigger and better things. It took a little while for him to get there. Also on this show, Mankind and The Undertaker had their first match ever. Pretty good match, with Mankind getting what at that time certainly was a rare win, a submission win no less, with the Mandible Claw over the Dead Man. That would be the first match in a series of matches between the two of them. And this match wasn't bad, but they went on to have so many better matches. I mean, the Boiler Room Brawl at SummerSlam was a fantastic match. Their Buried Alive match was actually pretty good. The Hell in a Cell, which we'll get to in a second. So this was their first. Ahmed Johnson won his first and only singles title in WWF on this show. He beat Goldust for the Intercontinental Championship, and opened the match with a suicide dive to the floor that completely missed Goldust. I'm still to this day not sure how Ahmed didn't kill himself doing it. It was frightening. If you watch nothing else from this match, find this match online, watch the first 2 minutes, and you'll see what I'm talking about. The Ultimate Warrior actually wrestled on this show, his only King of the Ring appearance, if you can call it wrestling. He beat Jerry Lawler in a 3-minute squash, and by the very next month, Warrior was already gone from the company. And that would be it for him in WWF, as it would turn out. He never did come back. 1997. If there are two matches I would pluck from this show and say that you should go out of your way to watch, Triple H and Mankind in the finals of the tournament had a pretty good match. Again, they would go on to have a whole host of matches years later. And Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels. This was the match that should have taken place at SummerSlam the year before. By this point, both guys were basically babyfaces. They were actually tag team champions. And they were pitted in a one-on-one non-tournament match against each other. Originally, Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels were going to have a match on this show. That match was actually announced on television. Shawn, the story goes, Shawn wanted each member of the Hart Foundation handcuffed to the ring post. Bret Hart said that if he couldn't beat Shawn in 10 minutes or less, he would never again wrestle in the United States. But the fact is, Bret had a legit knee injury at the time. Things were real bad behind the scenes with him and Shawn as it was. And so those factors taken together, the match never happened. And instead it became Austin versus Michaels, who, as I mentioned, were tag team champions at the time. Originally the plan was Bret versus Shawn in a 10-minute match and Steve Austin versus Brian Pillman, which in theory sounds like a tremendous show on paper, but really, I don't know how good either of those matches would have been. You know, again, Bret versus Shawn going 10 minutes... Right there, you're handicapping it. Those guys should be allowed to go 20 or 30, and you're saying right away, this match is not going to go that long. That's number one. Number two, Bret did have the knee injury. So even if he wrestled, how much really could he have done? That's why they were padding that match with so many stipulations. The 10-minute time limit, the Hart Foundation members outside handcuffed to the ring. They were coming up with all the smoke and mirrors to try to get Bret through that match. It's probably better off he didn't wrestle at all. And with Austin Pillman, they did end up doing that match on Raw 1 week after the pay-per-view. And it really, yeah, to be honest with you, it really wasn't a blow-away match of any kind. Pillman, with his ankle as it was, he was a physical wreck at that time and couldn't do much. His ankle had been fused together. He was in constant pain. The mobility he once had was gone. He wasn't the wrestler he used to be. I doubt their pay-per-view match would have been much different than the one they had on Raw. So in the end, it probably worked out for the better. We had Austin and Michaels, who had a really, really good match long before they ever wrestled for the title at WrestleMania. In a lot of ways, I think this match was better than that WrestleMania match. Funny moment, there was a young handicapped boy sitting at ringside who actually jumped the rail early on in the Austin Michaels match. And I guess Shawn Michaels kind of looked outside. He saw security. I don't know if the security guards were roughhousing it with the kid or being a little more aggressive than maybe they had to, but Shawn went out there and basically told the guys to back off, leave the kid alone. And in the middle of this match here on pay-per-view, Shawn has this kid, because he already hopped the barricade, and he's casually walking with the kid and helping him down the aisle. All of a sudden, we see the kid's mother, who probably also came over the barricade. She's running to go, you know, meet Shawn and the kid to grab her kid. So it's just a very... a weird moment during the match, I guess, that a lot of people may not remember. And as I mentioned, Helmsley finally getting his elusive King of the Ring victory 1 year later. Better late than never, I suppose. He would go on to meet Mankind in a match, a rematch of the finals at SummerSlam. They opened the show in a steel cage, and Foley won. So it's not as though Triple H went on to big things right away either. 1998. Is perhaps the most memorable King of the Ring show, I think it might be safe to say, and has nothing to do with the tournament itself. Lost in that is a really good finals match in the King of the Ring tournament. Ken Shamrock and The Rock, who had a feud that extended into 1998 and a WrestleMania match, had what I thought was actually a really good match in the finals of this tournament. Shamrock, in the end, made Rock tap out to the ankle lock. Ken Shamrock won the King of the Ring in 1998. Did not go on to get a world title match, but did win the Intercontinental Championship a few months later. But this match was all about Undertaker and Mankind. Hell in a Cell. This was a feud that had been going on since 1996. And much like the Bret Hart-Jerry Lawler feud, there was kind of a lull. It wasn't like it was a straight feud for 2 years. They feuded, they had a couple of matches, then they kind of went on to do their own things, and eventually they kind of revisited the rivalry. Same thing with Bret and Lawler. That's what they did with these two guys. And they had a lot to live up to, because that first Hell in a Cell match the year before with Bret, and or I should say Shawn and Undertaker, was an all-time classic. And Mankind physically wasn't exactly in a position to have the same kind of match that, say, a Shawn Michaels could have. And so I guess he felt as though, well, we've got to do something really out there to make this match memorable and give people their money's worth. And boy, did he ever. I think we all know what happened. The big bump off the top of the cell. Match should have been over at that point. Comes back, climbs back up, chokeslam through. Foley has maintained for years, including in his book, that fall, the second fall through the cage, was not planned. Everything else was, but that wasn't. He would know more than I would, so I'll take his word for it. I've always thought that's a crock of crap, because if you watch it, just watch what happens on top of the cell when that happens. Undertaker doesn't even really chokeslam him so much as he just kind of lifts him up off his feet a little bit and shoves him backwards. It just seemed way too convenient to me. I mean, ask yourself this question. If Foley did not go through the cage, if Foley was not supposed to go through the cage that second time, then what was the point of climbing back up on top of the cell? You just did a spot on top of the cage where you got thrown off 16 feet to the floor. It's going to be impossible to top that. Instead of leaving well enough alone, you climb back up to the top of the cage. The only way you could possibly top what you just did was to get your ass thrown off again. So, I love Mick Foley. And again, he would know better than I would, but I find that suspect. But as a match, you won't find a more memorable match maybe in company history than this one. I can't say it's a great wrestling match. It wasn't a wrestling match. It was a brawl. It was a fight. I remember watching it live, and it was incredible. I had never seen anything like it in my life. And then the thumbtacks, which we had never seen before on WWE television. We see thumbtacks. He gets chokeslammed on that. Tombstoned. This was the very definition of a war. And it's a match that I have no doubt took years off Foley's career. When I saw Foley less than a month later at Raw, I was a special guest in one of the luxury boxes at Monday Night Raw. Foley was brought into our luxury box to sign autographs and take pictures. And he just looked like a guy who was in pain. You know, he looked like a guy who probably should have been given a few months off after this match. The other match on this show, main event, was First Blood, Steve Austin, and Kane for the WWF Championship. Believe it or not, Foley came back out again at the end of that show. In that main event, he did a run-in. And in the end, it was Kane winning his first and only WWE Championship. Austin had been busted open by an errant chair shot from The Undertaker, who also interfered. Austin had the chair. He was ready to waffle Kane. Referee saw all the blood on Austin's face, and that was that. And Kane would lose the championship 24 hours later back to Austin on Monday Night Raw. It was just a way for them to pop a rating. They never had any intention of giving Kane a long title reign. And for years, it was a sore spot for Kane fans, myself included. I felt like the guy deserved a run with the belt. Interesting little trivia note is that Kane was, up to that point anyway, before Mankind won it, the first ever masked man to win the WWE Championship. He was the first man to wear a mask and have that title. So he's got that going for him, at least, in terms of the history books. 1999 saw Mr. Ass, Billy Gunn, get the big push. He won the King of the Ring tournament. They wanted to, I guess as they say in wrestling, strap the rocket to him and launch him up top. He won the tournament. SummerSlam, he ended up having his face buried, as Jim Ross said, in some large woman's ass. Quite a fall from grace for Billy Gunn. Billy Gunn was always a great athlete. Billy Gunn's a big dude. Billy Gunn is like 6'6", 200 and, you know, whatever. He was 260, 270, but he's a tall guy. So he had the physical size, the look. He had the charisma, personality. On the microphone, he was okay. He was never any great shakes. In the ring, he was okay. He was never a fantastic wrestler or anything. It just, he never clicked. He never had it, I guess, as they would say. So they tried, and it didn't quite work out with Billy Gunn as the King of the Ring. The other thing I remember about this show, two things actually. Number one, Undertaker defended the championship against The Rock. I had met The Rock less than a week earlier. Rock actually came to Brooklyn. He was at some auto dealership for some reason doing a signing. I happened to have a friend whose mother worked at the dealership, got us in there. So I had a chance to meet The Rock for the first time way back in 99. Seemed like a pretty down-to-earth kind of guy. The woman that was with The Rock, actually, at that signing, was a woman by the name of Sue Aitchison, who for years worked for WWE. She might still work there, I'm not sure. The reason I bring that up is, many years later on SmackDown, they did a segment where Vince McMahon was looking for somebody to be his personal assistant, or whatever the title was. He was having interviews in the ring. So there was a desk in the ring, Vince was sitting there, and he was going to interview a whole bunch of candidates. And they brought out this guy who was acting very effeminate, and Vince kicked him out. There was a woman maybe who was brought down, like an older lady, I don't remember. But then they brought out this woman who looked awfully familiar to me. I said, I know this woman. I've seen her before. And sure enough, that's who it was. It was Sue Aitchison. They said, listen, we're going to use you for this on-air segment on TV. And she was the first person that Vince brought out. And he was very complimentary of her. You know, you're very pretty. And, you know, you could type a lot of words per minute. And then Stacey Keibler came out and basically told her to hit the bricks and did this table dance for Vince. And, yeah, it was quite the segment. But anyway, that's a little side story there. Undertaker and Rock had a match. It really was nothing special. The main event was a handicap ladder match. Steve Austin, who was the CEO of the company, was putting up his shares of the company against Vince and Shane McMahon. And what I remember about this was the pay-per-view went off the air at 10:27 p.m. Eastern. I was furious. At that time, and even today, I mean, you're conditioned to expect the pay-per-views to go off the air at 10:45, 10:50, whatever. 10:27 p.m. is when this pay-per-view went off the air. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, that's it? Even the finish was kind of lame. They had Austin about to reach up to grab the briefcase, and some mystery man was lifting the briefcase higher and higher, so Austin couldn't reach it. And the next night we found out, now I don't even know if they ever really explained that it was the Big Boss Man. I think it was just we were led to assume that it was the Boss Man. I don't know that they ever actually came out and told us who lifted up the briefcase. I assume it was the Big Boss Man. But Vince and Shane won. They got control of the company back. And the first order of business on Raw the next night was to fire Steve Austin as the CEO of the company. So that was the 1999 show. And the 99 show was the first King of the Ring since the first one in 93 to really pop a big buy rate. But not really surprising because at that time, WWE was just at its peak. The month before, Raw had done its biggest ratings of all time. I mean, business was on fire at that point. 2 months later, they took the company public. So naturally, all of their events were kicking ass at the time. And the King of the Ring was really no exception. 2000. Was the rise of Kurt Angle, the ascent of the Olympic gold medalist, as a main event player in WWE. Angle had already been the European champion, the Intercontinental champion. He won the King of the Ring tournament, and a few months later, he beat The Rock on pay-per-view to become WWF champion for the very first time. So I know there's been a lot of guys like Brock Lesnar, Randy Orton. I mean, you can name people who have started and have risen very quickly. Lesnar may be the only person that you could say had a faster rise than Kurt, but Kurt's rise was more impressive in that he won a whole bunch of titles, then he won King of the Ring, then he won the championship. I don't know that anybody really has had as impressive a first year and a rise in WWE than Kurt Angle. So this show just kind of solidified it. The main event, this was something where if this had taken place today, I would have railed on what a crappy idea it was. And to be honest, it was a crappy idea then, too. It was basically, Rock won the championship back from Triple H, but not by beating Triple H, who he was embroiled in a feud with. That was when he won the title. Triple H won the Iron Man match, got the belt back. Rock won the championship by pinning Vince McMahon in a six-man tag. Anytime you have a world champion who loses his title in a multi-man match and isn't the one to get pinned, I think it's a bad idea, especially when the new champion pins the 50-something-year-old owner of the company to win the belt back. It just doesn't work. So that main event didn't work. The thing about the 2000 show that stands out to me, unfortunately, it's etched in my brain, there was a hardcore evening gown match. Now, you look at some of the divas that were on the roster at that time, and you think, wow, that certainly has some potential there. But the participants in this hardcore evening gown match, Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe. Yeah, that kind of throws some cold water on it, I think. It was for the Hardcore Championship, which was one of my favorite storylines from that era. the hardcore title, the 24/7 rule, Crash Holly, you know, doing everything he can to, you know, evade being beaten. Everybody would always be on the hunt for Crash Holly and would try to beat him for the championship. He had to be on the lookout at all times, have eyes in the back of his head. It was a hardcore evening gown match with Patterson and Briscoe, and somehow Crash Holly managed to win the belt back. But the images of Patterson and Briscoe in drag were images that I wish, if I had one of those Men in Black devices that could wipe my memory, I think for that reason alone, I would probably use it. 2001 had an awesome street fight with Kurt Angle and Shane McMahon. Shane, say what you want to about Shane. The guy was insane. He would take risks that, in my wildest dreams, I would never do half the shit that Shane McMahon did when he was having matches in WWF. And this match against Kurt Angle, Kurt didn't hold back. At one point, they brawled down the aisleway. Kurt tried a belly-to-belly suplex to suplex Shane through like a pane of glass or whatever it was, and it didn't break. So Shane hit the glass, fell straight down, landed right on his head. You could even hear the thud of his head hitting the concrete. And Kurt did it again. I think the second time it worked. There was another time where he tried to do it. It didn't work. I mean, Shane took a beating on those suplexes alone. Kurt also took a beating. I think he suffered a broken tailbone during this match. These guys beat the hell out of each other. It's the kind of match I don't think we would probably see today. And considering how the physical toll it took on their bodies, maybe that's for the better. Kurt won. If you've never seen their street fight before, it really is a great match. What was not a great match, and you can't even really call it a match, it was billed as a fight. Undertaker and Diamond Dallas Page. Undertaker didn't like DDP much. You could tell based on his treatment of DDP here in whatever the hell the segment was. DDP hardly got any offense in at all. It basically was, for 10 minutes or whatever, Undertaker just beating the crap out of DDP until DDP ran away through the crowd. That's it. That's all it was. And it's a shame, really, because I still think Diamond Dallas Page, when he first came in, could have really been something in WWE, and they really dropped the ball with him. I know he thinks very highly of himself. He wanted to come in and do a feud with The Rock. I don't know that they would have done that, but there's certainly other things you could have done, maybe to build up to something with DDP and The Rock. I know both used to call themselves the People's Champion, so it could have been a brawl over who the real People's Champion is. Instead, they gave him the stalker gimmick where he was being all creepy and stalking Undertaker's wife. And, you know, he tried to make the most of it, I guess. It was a high-profile feud for him on the way in, feuding with The Undertaker. It's just The Undertaker didn't reciprocate and treated him like a second-rate jobber. Edge was the winner of the King of the Ring tournament here in 2001. Obviously, they had big plans for Edge and started the breakup of Edge and Christian, who would go on to feud later in the year. And again, 2001 was another year where Edge was the King of the Ring winner, and it's not as though he went on to SummerSlam or an event right after to compete for the World Championship. They were very spotty on that. There really are only a few years where they did that. There was never any hard and fast rule like there is for the Royal Rumble, where it's specifically stated the winner will get a title shot, and here's when. And Edge certainly did not. The main event was a triple threat match, Steve Austin defending the WWE title against Chris Jericho and Chris Benoit, who had been tag team champions. And Benoit had suffered a neck injury in TLC 3. TLC 3 took place on SmackDown right after. In fact, it was taped the night after Jericho and Benoit won the tag team belts on Raw from Steve Austin and Triple H, one of the all-time great Monday Night Raw matches. It was the one where Triple H tore his quad that put him out for about 8 months. Benoit kept wrestling for weeks after that, but he had to have surgery after this triple threat match. I think WWE claimed on television that Benoit suffered the injury in this match, but that was just a cover excuse. He was already hurt going in. He was out for a year, and so he and Triple H both missed the entire Invasion storyline that unfolded. And whatever story they may have had in mind for a breakup of Triple H and Steve Austin never happened once Triple H got hurt. 2002 was the final King of the Ring pay-per-view event, and it had a great, I think the match opened the show, a great opening match in the tournament with Chris Jericho and Rob Van Dam. They had a really good match. Brock Lesnar won the tournament, beating RVD in the finals, and Brock Lesnar would in fact go on to compete for the championship at SummerSlam and to beat The Rock. Rock put him over like $1 million. Nassau Coliseum, Brock Lesnar, the youngest heavyweight champion of all time. And they called him the next big thing. They pushed him like it. He became the next big thing. When you stick to somebody, if you push them hard enough, and they're believable in the role, and God knows Brock Lesnar was certainly believable as this beast, this monster. He played his role perfectly. He was a great athlete. He had great matches. He was a made man. And the King of the Ring was the first step in that process. He had never held a championship before. He had only debuted on television, I believe it was about 2 months earlier. So the King of the Ring was the first step in that process of launching Lesnar into being something special. Also on this show, it was scheduled originally to be Steve Austin against Eddie Guerrero. Austin, however, walked out of the company over a creative dispute. Originally, they wanted to book Steve Austin in a television match on Raw, a King of the Ring match, I think maybe a qualifying match, but a King of the Ring match against Brock Lesnar. So they wanted to blow off the first Steve Austin-Brock Lesnar match on television, and Austin, rightfully so, took issue with this and said, I don't think it's a good idea. This match is money, me and him, down the road. I don't want to do it. Now, there were other issues at the time. I think Austin was just physically burned out, and there probably were other underlying issues, but it was the creative that he disagreed with, and ultimately it led to his departure from the company. Now, at the time, Austin was in a feud with Ric Flair, who was the co-owner of Raw. He was feuding with Stone Cold, and with him leaving, they blew off the whole storyline by hot-shotting a match on Raw for control of the company, where it was going to be Vince McMahon against Ric Flair. The winner would get full control of the company. So they did the match, Vince won, and just like that, Flair lost his ownership stake. So whatever long-term plans they had for that storyline were completely destroyed because they felt like, uh-oh, you know, Steve Austin's gone, we got to come up with something, let's do this. And Flair took Austin's spot in that match against Eddie Guerrero, so we never did get to see an Austin versus Eddie match, which at that point in Steve Austin's physical condition, I don't want to say it would have been a great match, it probably would have been a good match. Austin by that point physically was past his prime. It's funny to say he wasn't old per se, but in the physical shape he was in with his neck and his knees, they're really, you know, he could have good matches, but it wasn't like he was knocking him dead every week and blowing everybody away with his work rate in the ring. But still, it's a shame we never got to see that match. Kurt Angle beat Hulk Hogan on this show, and I wanted to bring this up because this is kind of a big deal. Hogan was the babyface, Kurt was the heel. They had a match, and Kurt Angle beat Hulk Hogan by submission with the ankle lock. I cannot remember another clean submission win for a heel over Hulk Hogan as a babyface. I mean, Hogan would submit and stuff all the time when he was Hollywood Hogan as a heel in WCW. But as a babyface in either company, I cannot remember one other time where Hogan was beaten by submission. Brock Lesnar beat him on SmackDown, but Hogan didn't give up. Hogan just passed out, so he beat him in a bear hug. I don't count that. In this match, Hogan tapped out. And that's pretty impressive. So that's a feather in Kurt Angle's cap because nobody else before or since has been able to do that. The main event on this pay-per-view was Undertaker Triple H. It was the most ungodly boring match you'll ever see. It was a terrible finish. It's kind of amazing when you look at this match and you compare it to the ones that the two of them would have later on at WrestleMania. You know, especially that WrestleMania 27 match, which I thought had great drama, was very good. This match was anything but. And, just go back and watch the finish, even. It was, I think, Undertaker rolling a very haphazard, lazy-looking roll-up or something for the win. Just terrible stuff. 2006 is when the King of the Ring tournament returned. So 4 years had gone by without a King of the Ring tournament. And they decided to dust it off as a television gimmick. So over the course of several weeks on TV, they had King of the Ring matches. And ultimately, Booker T, I believe it was at the Judgment Day pay-per-view that year, won. I think he may have beaten Bobby Lashley in the finals, but he won the crown, and much like Harley Race 20 years earlier, in 1986, they decided to parlay this into an on-air television gimmick for Booker T. Booker T had been just kind of there. He wasn't really doing much. And as a heel, as King Booker, it gave him something to do. A few months later, he won the championship. He was in a world title feud. It really reinvigorated Booker T's career when he won in 2006. And at the time, I thought it was the most annoying gimmick in the world whenever he would say King Booker, and he would come out and his wife would say King Booker over and over and over again. Looking back, it was kind of a fun gimmick. Not my favorite Booker T gimmick, but it was something for him to do. 2008, so again, they skipped over a year. They brought back King of the Ring as a television gimmick. At the time, Raw would have these special three-hour shows every now and then. Of course, Raw now is permanently 3 hours, unfortunately. At the time, it was a special gimmick. They needed something special. So they said, why don't we have King of the Ring? We'll do the tournament all in one night. I think the longest match in this tournament, I looked it up, the longest match went 5 minutes, including a 20-second William Regal victory over Hornswoggle. And in the finals, it was CM Punk and William Regal. They went about 4 minutes. That match had a potential, had the potential to be great, and it went 4 minutes. Because again, 3 hour show, we don't have time for that. Regal had a great thing going on at the time. He was not just the king, but he was the general manager. He was as over during that period of time in 08, maybe 07 into 08, as any other period in his career. He transitioned into a feud with Mr. Kennedy. It saw him lose a match on Raw only a few weeks after he won the King of the Ring, where the loser would be fired. So Regal lost, and the very next day he was suspended for 60 days for his second wellness policy violation. It was the last big push of his career, and any chance of even a token world title run for him was flushed down the drain after this. I really think the way that Regal was going in 08, as over as he was the GM, he was the king, you could have put the world title, maybe not the WWE title, but you could have put the world title on him, even just briefly. That was the best shot he had of being champion, and he pissed it all away. 2010 saw what, to this point anyway, is the final King of the Ring tournament. King Sheamus and the Antlers. That's what I jotted down here in my notes. When I think of the King of the Ring in 2010, that's what I think of. I think of Sheamus. I think of the ridiculous antlers he wore on his head, and him proceeding to lose practically every single match on TV for the next 3 months, including a whole bunch of matches against the guy that he beat to become king in the first place, John Morrison. So John Morrison ended up getting the better end of this, even though he lost the King of the Ring. He beat Sheamus, I think, in practically every match after that they had. So it's like it kind of became the King of the Ring curse in 2010. The curse of the Irish, not the luck of the Irish. And it was probably the worst thing to ever happen to Sheamus' career. And think about that for a second. The whole point of the King of the Ring was to put somebody over. And it did the exact opposite with him in 2010. It took a long time to rehab Sheamus and get him back to a point of respectability, which eventually they did. But it goes against the whole concept of the King of the Ring in the first place. And that was the last one they ever did. It's now been 3 years. Technically, Sheamus is still King of the Ring. They haven't crowned a new king since. So the question is, did King of the Ring really help or hurt careers? You know, who did it help launch? When you look back at the list of winners from the pay-per-view era, I'm not going to bother with the years before that. There's a couple names that come up, and you can definitely say the King of the Ring helped a whole bunch of people. Steve Austin certainly helped him, gave him a platform. Kurt Angle, they had long-term plans for him. King of the Ring was just another step in the process, but it helped. It helped launch him into the, you know, the world title scene a few months later. Edge won the King of the Ring, and even though he didn't get launched into the world title picture right away, you know, Edge up to that point was a tag team guy, and it was the first sign that the company really saw something in Edge, and they saw singles potential in him. And by the next year, less than a year later, he was having great matches with Kurt Angle on pay-per-view. You know, go watch those two matches they had in April and May of 02, including the one where Kurt got his head shaved. That's great stuff. And it started with this King of the Ring win. You look at Brock Lesnar. The King of the Ring certainly helped Brock Lesnar's career. And it gave new life in 2006 to Booker T. Even though it was meant just to be a, you know, a television gimmick, it gave him new life. It gave him a world title run. I think the last one that he had in his career. So the King of the Ring definitely helped a bunch of people. I won't say the King of the Ring hurt anybody except for Sheamus. I think Sheamus is the only guy I can point to where I can say the King of the Ring actually hurt him. Everybody else, like Mabel and, you know, Mr. Ass and Ken Shamrock, they were just the chosen flavor of the month. In the case of Billy Gunn, they wanted to push him. They tried to. Just didn't work out for him. And the bigger question is, should the King of the Ring be brought back? I've always been partial to the King of the Ring tournament. I like tournaments. I know WWE doesn't. Vince McMahon doesn't. If they did, they'd do more of them. But I always had a soft spot for the King of the Ring, and it goes back to that first tournament on pay-per-view back in 93. Like I said, that's still my favorite to this day. And it's my favorite, not just because of the time period and a lot of the personalities that were involved, but because you felt that it meant something. You know, to watch Bret Hart have to wrestle three straight matches on pay-per-view in one night and come back out for the second match with, you know, broken fingers, and the story that they were telling on commentary, which is important. You know, the announcers also have to do a very good job of getting it over and making it feel special, and they did. That first tournament was great, you know, and the tournament with Owen also, maybe that wasn't my favorite, but again, Owen had to beat a whole bunch of people in one night to become the King of the Ring. And when they started doing the deal where only the semifinals and finals would take place on pay-per-view, to me, like I said, that's where it started to die a death. Because all of a sudden, it went from being about the tournament to the tournament almost being an afterthought and a backdrop to whatever other title matches and whatever else they were going to put on the pay-per-view. And it's not that impressive. If you've already had a whole bunch of matches on television, and all you have to do is go to the pay-per-view, and now you got to win two matches in one night instead of one, it doesn't have that same special feel. And I've always maintained that they've got a great formula with the Royal Rumble and WrestleMania. That's why it's still going to this day. It works. It's been working since the early 90s. The Royal Rumble is a fun match. It's a fun event. A lot of different personalities. And it's structured where you know going in that the winner of the Royal Rumble is going to get a title match at WrestleMania. Now, they'll say, well, the main event at WrestleMania. You look back over the last few years, WWE's definition of the main event is... I'm not too sure about that one, because you had a couple years there where the winner of the Rumble opened the show. To me, that's not the main event. That makes you a curtain jerker. But for years, it was the winner gets a title match at WrestleMania. That's a big deal, and WrestleMania is the biggest event of the year. So why not do the same thing with the King of the Ring and SummerSlam? SummerSlam is supposed to be their second biggest event of the year. I'm more partial to the Rumble, but in theory, SummerSlam is supposed to be the second biggest event of the year and the biggest event of the summer. So why not have a similar system in place that you're consistent with from year to year? Have the King of the Ring pay-per-view the month or two before. You've got all these other gimmick shows. You know, Payback, for example, is this new WWE pay-per-view taking place in the month of June. Here in 2013, it's no special gimmick. It's just another pay-per-view name. And will this show do an amazing number of buys? Probably not. You could easily replace one of these B-level gimmick shows with the King of the Ring. And specifically say the winner of the tournament earns themselves a title match at SummerSlam, and because now you have two championships, you allow them, like you do with the Rumble, to choose which champion they want to go after. Do they want to go after the WWE title, or do they want to go after the World Heavyweight Championship? So you can have a younger guy maybe win the King of the Ring, get some rub, but if you don't think he's ready to wrestle, let's say, John Cena for the title, that's fine. Then let him choose the World Heavyweight Champion and go after that title. It's a way for them to get their foot in the door into a meaningful feud. Or you could have a guy like a Daniel Bryan. I've suggested before that Bryan and Cena should headline SummerSlam this year. And there's a whole bunch of different ways that you can get to that match. Well, why not have Bryan win the King of the Ring tournament? The guy's on a roll. He's got a lot of momentum. He's trying to prove he's not the weak link. If they had already set up a King of the Ring tournament for this pay-per-view coming up, I mean, it would just merge nicely into that pay-per-view. Bryan's a man on a mission. He goes in there. He wins three matches in one night. And he says, you know what? I want to challenge John Cena. And you've got your main event set up. I think there's so many possibilities. You've got all this new talent coming up that would benefit from something like this, from winning a tournament. But the key is you got to make it mean something. The reason the King of the Ring fell off a cliff was because they did very little to make it feel special. And I know the primary reason why they dumped the event was because, you know, in terms of pay-per-view buy rates, it really wasn't performing well. If you look at the pay-per-view buy rates for the King of the Ring, the first one did very well. And from there, it was kind of a steady decline until you hit 1998-99, which is when things were picking up during the Attitude Era. And the show was still doing well after that, even though it had dropped back down a little bit. It wasn't like it was doing, you know, record low, bottomed out numbers. And they just felt, it's not doing so well, we're going to get rid of it. Well, I think it's time to revisit it. I think there's a lot that can be gained by having a King of the Ring tournament. I think when you have it as a television concept, as a gimmick on TV, you could certainly do that, but it doesn't have that same special feel. So yeah, it doesn't have to be a pay-per-view. I think it should be. I think it's time to try again to bring back the King of the Ring, make it mean something, make sure that you make it very clear the winner will get a title match at SummerSlam. They get to choose which champion they want to go after. You've got all this new talent being brought up, whether it's The Shield or it's Bray Wyatt, and they may bring up some even some newer names in the near future. I mean, they brought up Bo Dallas months earlier, and they started a feud with him and Wade Barrett, and then 1 week, Bo Dallas just disappeared from TV. He eliminated the Intercontinental Champion from the Rumble. He beat him in a match on Raw, and shortly after that, he was gone. They sent him back down to NXT. Why would you do that? What does he gain from that? Why not put him in the King of the Ring tournament? Whether he wins or not, put him in the King of the Ring. Let him have a couple of impressive wins. You can get people over that way. It's a great tool. And I love the concept, and I think it should be brought back. Hope you enjoyed this special edition of the Solomonster Sounds Off here on this, the 20th anniversary, the very first King of the Ring pay-per-view back in 1993. If you like what you hear and want to hear more of these theme shows, you can always visit the official website of the Solomonster Sounds Off. That is thesolomonster.com, and you can make a PayPal donation there on that page, which is certainly very helpful to me with all the time and work that goes into doing these shows. It is not required, but certainly it is a way that you could contribute to the show if you would like to. There's a little PayPal donate box on the right side of the website if you scroll down just a little bit. Again, that's on thesolomonster.com, and your donations help keep the show going, so I very much appreciate that. Follow me on Twitter, 24/7, at Solomonster. And you can listen to this show every single weekend on sescoops.com, Stitcher Radio, or subscribe in iTunes to hear the Solomonster Sounds Off. I'm out of here. We'll see you next time.